Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, we'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping the future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, can Helen Ziller revive Johannesburg's finances and restore investor confidence? The debate over banning liquor advertising takes a new turn. The December Arto rollout looms, motorists face license suspensions and tougher penalties. And SME confidence takes a knock, a new index shows small business owners bracing for tougher months ahead. It's Friday, the 26th of September. Now, by now you'll be well aware that Helen Ziller has thrown her hat into the ring to run as mayor of Johannesburg. This past week, she's been on a high-profile media tour, doing countless interviews. It's our turn now, and I want to go in a slightly different direction, where City Hall meets business. And this is my argument. Unless there is strong local government, the economy of the country's powerhouse is going to keep stalling, and that has an implication for the entire country. Helen Ziller, a very warm welcome to you. The city's debt, corruption and decay, as you well know, are scaring off business in the city. What immediate steps would you take to turn that around should you be elected?
Well, one of the very first things I'm going to do is appoint someone in my office to be in charge of public-private partnerships, which won't only ask business to help us solve the problems in the city, but will look very carefully at the problems that businesses face in the city and make it a priority to deal with those, for the simple reason that we're never going to get job creation and we're never going to get people out of poverty without businesses investing and having confidence in the future of Johannesburg. And at the moment, the sad thing is that many businesses are leaving Johannesburg. They're either going to Midvale or they're going to other places in the Western Cape. They're going to where the DA governs, and we have to show them that it's worth staying in Joburg to invest and to grow and to create jobs there, because Joburg has a great future.
Helen, you'll be well aware that overnight a coterie of South African business leaders say they've been discussing with government whether they can help revive Johannesburg. Business for South Africa says, and I quote, they'll assess whether they can assist the government and make a decision on whether to devote their resources to fixing the city. No doubt you would welcome that. How do you think you would work with that group if you're putting public-private partnership at the centre of all of this?
I would warmly welcome that kind of move. And obviously, I have to look at all the business institutions and make sure that we're getting an inclusive focus. But the various business organizations, I'm sure, will have mutually complementary but different focuses. And we don't have to only do one thing. I mean, the most critical thing to try and solve is the water problem, and then obviously the electricity reticulation problem, because businesses can't work with either of those being offline. So we have to get that right. And anything that business can do to assist us in that process, other than being tenderpreneurs and sabotaging the water infrastructure so they can get tenders to provide the water tankers, that is when so-called business forums and other organizations become very unhelpful, because they sabotage the infrastructure because they see an opportunity to extract resources from the municipal government. Now, that's one form of business involvement we really don't want. We want honest people who want the place to work.
Well, let's talk about water and electricity for that matter. You'll be well aware that the city of Johannesburg owes Eskom and Rand Water a countless millions. What would your plan be to settle those debt without blackouts that in many respects the city has been experiencing?
Well, the very first thing we have to do is ring fence the money for those utilities. There's quite a bit of money coming in and more available from national government if we ring fence that money. But we've seen the example of that money just disappearing. 4 billion rand was apparently allocated for maintenance of the water infrastructure, which is a drop in the ocean compared to what's actually needed. But 4 billion is 4 billion and it can go quite a distance. And then suddenly that was reallocated, and the mayor can't tell us where it's been reallocated to. Now, that is the most extraordinary situation I've ever heard. How 4 billion rand in a budget can be reallocated without the mayor's knowledge is beyond my comprehension. I don't know how these things happen. So this is exactly where the problem lies. There's money for the utilities, but then somebody thinks there's another priority, normally to give a tender to somebody or to pay salaries of a massively bloated upper echelon of management in the city, and the money just disappears. And then the mayor can't tell you where the money for the maintenance of the water has gone. Now, that is an incomprehensible situation. So the first thing you have to do is ring fence the budget for the utilities.
Part of it, of course, is money coming in. And you'll also be aware that Johannesburg loses billions in unpaid services. How do you stop the leakage?
Well, that's a very, very difficult one. There are different levels to that problem. One is people stealing water and electricity. That's one big one. The other is 46% of Joburg's water leaking away through unmaintained pipes. And the third is people not paying for their rates and service charges. And many people don't want to pay for their rates and service charges because they say, I don't get the service, so why should I pay? So it becomes a vicious cycle. The projections for Johannesburg's revenue are usually to achieve a balanced budget, but they never meet the revenue projections. And they always exceed the spending projections, which makes it a downward spiral and a race to the bottom. Now, I'm afraid that people are going to understand that they have to pay for services. If they get services beyond the free basic allocation, which we will continue to give, obviously, because people deserve free basic services to live a dignified life. But beyond that free basic allocation, people are going to have to pay. And it may be a hard lesson to learn, but that's how we did it in Cape Town, and now people do pay. There was first massive resistance to water meters. Then we said to people, okay, we're putting in the water meters because that gives you better control of how much you're using. And if no one in your house is using and the meter is still running up, then you know there's a leak. And if you put in a meter and we find a leak, we will fix it for free, but only if you put in a meter. And that is how we overcame that resistance. And that's how we brought the water leakage is down to one of the lowest in the world in the city of Cape Town. In Joburg, as I've just said, they lose 46% of their water, and Joburg loses as much water as Tshwane uses every day. It's just an incomprehensible figure.
Would you commit to capping annual tariff hikes, yes or no?
I haven't studied the budget enough to know what's feasible. I have studied, for example, the revenue projections, the fact that they always fall short of their revenue projections, the fact that they always exceed on their spending projections. And we would like to go for a balanced budget. That's obviously the objective. And I would like to make absolutely sure that the budgets for utilities are ring-fenced, and we have to stop corruption, and we have to stop this huge bloating of the upper echelons of the management cadres in the city and the duplication of functions. And I'm hoping when we have done all of that, the budget will look a bit better and a lot more manageable and a lot more predictable for the public. And then we can say what we can promise and what we can't promise.
Urban decay has wrecked commercial property values in the city, Helen Zille. Would you use tax breaks or SEZs, special economic zones, to lure developers back?
Well, I would do anything possible to lure developers back. I mean, I don't know if you know Davies Street in the middle of Joburg. Mm. Davies Street is a model of what Joburg could become. It is in the middle of one of the most degraded sections of Joburg. The streets around it are horror zones, something like out of a cop apocalypse now. And then suddenly you come to Davies Street. It's green, it's got benches, it's clean, it's got lovely buildings, all with biometric access control. And I said, what's going on here? And they said the private sector came in here and they wanted to construct student accommodation. So they went into all those totally derelict buildings. They bought them out. They've renovated them. Most of the students there are on NSFAS grants. They're paying every month as they have to. And there's security there. They're nice outside tables, chairs, benches, greenery everywhere, paved platforms and everything. It's just a different world. And I said, surely we could extend this model to the rest of the city. And the people who are responsible for that said to me, yes, we could, with a more amenable city council. It took them 8 years to get the permission to make Davie Street bloom again. So we have to get that kind of public-private partnership. There are lots of people who are willing to go into the center of Joburg and buy out those derelict buildings and revitalize them. But it also means ensuring that the hijackers aren't in control of those buildings, and that's going to be a difficult public order challenge.
Helen Ziller, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed, Jeremy.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, from December this year, just around the corner, South Africa's long-delayed ARTO system finally kicks in, and it is set to change the way every motorist deals with traffic fines. It introduces demerit points, license suspensions, and stricter penalties for non-payment. With millions of fines issued annually and fraud already on the rise, I guess the stakes for motorists and businesses are high. Well, let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Barry Berman, Chief Executive Officer of Fines SA. It is a traffic fine platform. Barry, it's taken government more than a decade to implement ARTO. Do you think we're ready this time around?
Yes, Jeremy, I definitely do believe that. In fact, it's been, I think, over 15 years that we've been waiting for this. So the pilot, which has been running in Joburg and Tshwane, has now been fine-tuned. And I do believe it's ready. And yeah, all systems are go for 1 December.
What do you think the single biggest risk is for ordinary motorists when ARTO takes effect? It's 1 December, right?
That is correct. So I think there's been apathy for many years with traffic fines in South Africa. I mean, the existing system was launched in 1977 and the payment rates have been quite low. Motorists are now going to get a very big surprise, because what's happening is that they are going to get these auto infringements, which are very quickly going to escalate to enforcement orders, which then mean that they're going to be blocked on the system. So government is not going to be coming after the motorists. They're going to be blocking them on the Enator system, which then means that the motorists are not going to be able to transact at all, which means buying a car, selling a car, renewing their car license disc, even renewing their driver's license. And then they are going to be forced at that point to pay. So it's going to be a big mind shift. In the mind of the motorist.
Barry, many municipalities struggle to run basic billing systems. That is a fact. What confidence should we have that they can actually run ARTO efficiently?
Yes, I think the difference with the existing CPA system and the new system is that the new system is going to be a national system. So it's actually run, you know, at a national level. And then they have engaged with multiple technology partners who are assisting on the back end. So I'm not saying that it's going to be 100% smooth sailing at the beginning. I'm sure there will be some teething problems, but we're pretty confident that they've ironed out most of the glitches.
How does the system handle informal or unregistered vehicles that already escape enforcement right now?
Look, that's obviously going to be a major challenge, because the infringements are going to be linked to either the ID number of the owner of the vehicle or to the BRN, which is the company business registration number. So, you know, if those numbers are fraudulent, it's going to be a tough task. And I'm not sure if there is a clear policy in place on how to deal with that, but that will have to be a law enforcement issue, which they'll have to figure out if they haven't already got a plan.
If I understand this correctly, 15 demerit points can cost you your license. How quickly could an average driver hit that threshold?
Yes, you would be surprised how quickly you can hit it. One has to say that is going to be obviously only phased in. They're planning for that only to kick off in September 2026. So the first phase, you won't be losing the demerit points. But just to give you an idea, you know, you can lose a minimum of 1 point per infringement up to a maximum of 6 points. But if you drive and, you know, if you are an unlicensed driver, for example, that is 6 points gone in one go. If your vehicle is unlicensed, that's another 6 points, you know. And then obviously, depending on the speed, the lower speeds where you're exceeding the speed limits, maybe 1 or 2 points. But there are quite a few categories where you can lose 6 points in one go. And then that's going to create a major issue for those drivers who depend on driving for their livelihood.
If I've read this correctly, Barry, fraudsters are already circulating so-called ghost fines. How vulnerable do you think motorists are to scams under this new system?
This is recently a new phenomenon that we're seeing. What we are advising motorists to do is to be very cautious before they click on any links from companies that they've never heard of or from dodgy email addresses. We have a setup at Fines SA where you can call in. We've got hundreds of call center operators who can verify that the fines are legitimate. We can send copies of the fines as well, which is a very important step, in confirming with the motorists that it was actually their vehicle and them driving. A lot of motorists are also in denial, so that also helps just to confirm that actually it is a legitimate fine. We have a WhatsApp number, we have an email address. So there are ways that we would advise motorists to check. Those clients who have signed up on the Fines SA platform or on the app, then they will be used to receiving WhatsApps from us and emails. So I would suggest, using the legitimate channels.
Barry Berman, Chief Executive Officer, Fines SA. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa is once again debating a total ban on alcohol advertising and sponsorship. The Economic Freedom Fighters has revived the issue in Parliament, tabling a private member's bill that would outlaw alcohol promotions and sponsorship across sport, media and events. Now, supporters say it's a vital step to curb abuse and save lives. Critics warn it could devastate broadcasters, sports bodies and the entertainment economy. Let's discuss this in a little more detail. I'm in conversation now with Maurice Smithers from the organization Working for an Alcohol Safer South Africa. Maurice, what do you believe is the right path here? Is a total ban necessary now? Is there evidence that suggests that partial restrictions don't work?
The evidence, as with everything, when you're dealing with social issues, is mixed, but definitely seems to be in most independent research. And I stress independent research because there is other research which tends to be independent, but in fact is often sponsored by the liquor industry itself. Mm. Research tends to show that restricting or banning alcohol advertising and sponsorships, by the way, not just advertising, but sponsorships as well, taken in conjunction with other steps, such as reducing availability or increasing the price of alcohol or effective law enforcement and so on, will actually result in a reduction in alcohol harm, alcohol consumption, and in alcohol harm. So the evidence seems to be pretty clear. And there are countries like Russia, for example, which is a very, very impressive example of that.
Broadcasters, of course, warn, and sports bodies, that they would lose hundreds of millions in sponsorships. It would have a direct impact down the supply chain as far as jobs are concerned. It would be difficult to fill that gap, wouldn't it?
Well, let's look back at what happened with tobacco advertising. 1999, tobacco advertising was prohibited in South Africa, and exactly the same issues were raised. That sports codes would shut down. The SABC and other people said that they would lose enormous amount of money. One newspaper even said that they feared their demise if tobacco advertising was withdrawn. And in 2013, interestingly, when the same furor arose when the Minister of Health introduced the Control of Marketing of Alcohol Beverages Bill, which never saw the light of day, the same newspaper had an editorial in which they said that they had been proven wrong, that that they made all the same noise around tobacco back in 1999, and they were still there. So the second example I want to give is something I read recently about Australia. that in Australia, when they introduced a ban on sponsorships, they actually implemented the funding of sports and cultural activities through a health promotion fund that was set up in the country. In South Africa, by the way, when tobacco advertising was banned, the gap was taken up by the cell phone companies and by banks and various other parts of the economy. And there's no reason to suppose that wouldn't happen with alcohol as well. I mean, people sort of, doomsayers will say, well, that'll be the end of rugby or that'll be the end of sport. Yeah, really, very likely. I mean, who in South Africa is going to allow rugby or sport or cricket to die? It's just not going to happen. It's scare stories.
Do you think, given global changes towards public health and perhaps a more healthy approach, is there more of an appetite for this debate now in 2025 than perhaps there was 10 years ago?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt that the world has changed, and that as a result of those changes, what has actually happened is that countries that you would think would be much more reluctant to introduce changes like this would not have done it. But take two examples. Russia. I mean, everybody has this image of Russia as, you know, these vodka-swilling people. The fact is that through the efforts that they have implemented, there was a 43% reduction in alcohol consumption in that country and an increase in life expectancy of 10 years. Even in France, which everybody associates as a country like these Mediterranean countries where kids drink wine from a young age, alcohol consumption has actually been going down steadily. Mm. And they are one of the countries that have actually banned alcohol advertising. And so you know, it's quite evident that, you know, one of the things that I think that we fail to understand as society is that a lot of the things that we do, like smoking, for example, you know, when tobacco was introduced to the world about 600 years ago, when it came across from America to Europe and it became ubiquitous worldwide, nobody knew what the problems were. Nobody knew it was going to be associated with cancer. But once you have that information, you have to act on it. And it's the same with alcohol. I'm busy writing a book about alcohol at the moment, and people don't really understand why it is that alcohol is legal and why we use it in the way that we do, why there's a reluctance to actually, by many people, to see any regulation of alcohol. But, you know, the fact is that today we know what alcohol is. We know what it's made up of. We know what the chemical reaction in our bodies is. We know what the impact on our bodies is. There's a doctor in the UK, Dr. David Nutt, who wrote a paper in which he said, if alcohol were to be discovered today for the first time, it would probably not be approved for human consumption, because we've only had regulatory bodies that control what we can eat and what we can use as medicine for our protection. Mm. These regulatory bodies have only been in existence for less than 150 years in most countries. We have to learn that, you know, we have to look at things in light of new information. That's what a lot of people aren't doing.
Well, it's going to be very interesting to see whether this debate has political support, the political support it needs to become law, yep. Or maybe it's just a signal of intent rather than a real prospect. But the debate certainly has been reignited. And that's where we are going to leave it. Maurice Smithers from the organization working for an alcohol safer South Africa. Thank you very much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's small and medium enterprises began this year with a degree of optimism, but I'm going to tell you that confidence has taken a shock. The Q1 2025 SME Confidence Index from Business Partners Limited shows decline across all indicators. There is a problem with fiscal uncertainty. You'll remember the delayed budget, a 75 billion rand shortfall, and obviously rand volatility weighing heavily on small business sentiment. So let's discuss the findings with David Morobe, who is Executive General Manager Impact Investing at Business Partners Limited. So David, good evening to you and a very warm welcome. The delayed budget and revenue shortfall. In practical terms, how has this impacted on SME planning?
Well, first thing, all SMEs require certainty as to what is happening. Not only SMEs, by the way, also just business in general. So with a delayed budget, everybody was unsure what's going to happen. And that what compounded it was that there were sort of murmurs about the increase in VAT. So how do you plan? Because you take steps ahead, you don't know what's going to happen, and in the end, that VAT did not happen. And this is the feedback we are receiving from our SMEs from the survey for quarter one.
And that was the problem, because so many of those small companies were anticipating a hike. It tells us a lot about policy clarity, doesn't it?
Indeed, not only the SMEs, no, big business, all of us actually expected something to happen regarding the VAT. But clearly, the basis of the policy change was not well informed. And then the corollary effect for that sort of uncertainty was the SMEs also feeling very uncertain. It pointed to some kind of volatility from a fiscal framework perspective, as well as political volatility, because you never know which party is going for what. And there was, without a clear majority, we are all left in tenterhooks, in particular our small and medium enterprises.
What is of more concern to me, and this is a disturbing number, is confidence in accessing finance falling to 62%. It does beg the question why funding is still such a stubborn hurdle.
It can never not be, because it's one of the elements that fuel a business operation. So invariably, whilst it has dropped, it was only in correlation to the challenges that they were facing at the time regarding planning and debt. But it's still a huge need for SMEs. They need to be funded, they need cash flow, and they need to be supported without ever technical assistance is there. And notwithstanding the drop that we saw, those elements will remain important components of what small and medium enterprises require to remain sustainable.
And David, the index also showing Rand volatility hitting around a third of SMEs. What sectors were most exposed?
Well, the ones that were most exposed are those that are dealing with some kind of export element, or in perhaps importing elements from abroad, that they had to face this volatility. Once again, I'd like to emphasize that the issue of stability, not only around the economy, but also mediums of exchange, such as the volatility showed with the rand, are important, especially if we want to encourage an external focused economy, intra-Africa trade. The more stable that is, the better. And then that's what sort of the feedback we received in terms of the sentiment of SMEs regarding this element. It was also compounded by the geopolitical situation that was ushered in by the advent of our new president in the United States entering, clearly pointing to say there's going to be a change in how things are done with SMEs on the African continent.
And none of us should be surprised that a shortage of skill remains a concern, but it's becoming more damaging, I would imagine, for SME growth as skills become more rare.
One cannot overemphasize that, and especially if you take it in the face of the high unemployment levels that we have in the country. So they need the skill sets, but the skill sets seem to be a mismatch with what our SMEs require. So I think it's something that we need to make sure the parties work together, that is private sector and the public sector per se, government per se, to make sure that skills that are needed by the economy are sort of encouraged and pushed, because that way our SMEs can benefit. It's been something that has been always coming through all the surveys that we've conducted with our SME Confidence Index.
Talking about confidence, confidence in government support is below 50%. Is there any signal that or reform that would help restore trust?
Well, first thing, it comes against the background of that policy uncertainty, where there was dilly-dallying around coming up with a budget that we could all rely upon. As you said in your intro, there was a 75 billion rand shortfall. Then we look at continual engagement with government. So it's important for these parties to work together, because government alone cannot solve all the problems that we face, including the unemployment crisis. Hence the drop that we have experienced. So I think there must be a collaborative effort. That's the only way that our businesses, especially small businesses, can be sustainable and thereby create the jobs that we require as an economy.
And just a final one, we've spoken a lot about the headwinds that SMEs face, but they do remain very tough. What do you see as the strongest opportunities for growth for the remainder of the year and going into 26?
Well, you know, what I like about SMEs is that they are eternal optimists. They are resilient. And if we take the background of what happened during the COVID period, they survived, and quite a significant number survived, notwithstanding all the challenges that they face. I think going forward, the idea of technological advancements, where most SMEs can get the digital tools to be able to reach customers far and wide, is probably at the next frontier that I see happening. Not so much sector specific, but having the tools to make your reach go far and wide. I've seen a number of SMEs offering what you think could be mundane goods and services, but because they've got a reach, they can be able to get customers beyond their immediate milieu and reach out to significant customer base.
We've been talking about the Q1 2025 SME Confidence Index. I've been in conversation with David Morobi, who's Executive General Manager, Impact Investing at Business Partners Limited.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
And that's where we are going to leave it for this Friday. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.